I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. After 4 days of shootouts between government forces and Islamic militants in and around the Saudi capital of Riyadh, Saudi officials say they have killed or captured 23 militants, including some of the country's most wanted. Joining us on the line first, Khalid Al-Mayina, editor of the Arab News. And Khalid, when did the shooting start and what provoked it?
Well, it started on last Sunday, and I think because the Saudi authorities now on the offensive mode, they have good intelligence, and they track these people to a city called Al Ras, which is a couple of hundred miles outside Riyadh. There was heavy shooting initially, and the police thought that they had really trapped these people, but suddenly there was a barrage of fire, heavy machine gun, rocket-propelled guns, RPGs, and other sort of ammunition were used. And I think police had to were taken in by surprise and had to call in reinforcement from around other cities, especially Riyadh. Initially, there was a problem because this was in an area where people live, a residential area. There was a school nearby, and the prime concern of the authorities was the safety of a group of school children who were nearby.
We understand that first battle went 3 days. Then some of those captured led authorities to a construction site yesterday where a new shootout began. Who was there? And describe the neighborhood where that shootout took place.
Well, this is called an industrial complex. These are factories. It's outside town, about 40 kilometers or more. And they tracked a guy called Mr. Yazji, who's apparently one of the bigwigs in the organization. And this was a prime capture. In fact, he was dead for the Saudis. What is good is that there's a great awareness program in Saudi Arabia now. So I think many of them are being pointed out by their own friends and kith and kin.
Khalid Al-Mayina is editor of the English language daily Arab News. He's speaking to us from Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. Khalid, thank you.
Thank you.
And for analysis now, we turn to Anthony Cordesman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. And Anthony, we just heard Khalid say that Saudis may in fact be pointing to terrorists, may be happy that militants are being arrested and killed. And a Saudi official, a terror expert, says that the shootout over the last 4 days shows that the terrorists in Saudi Arabia are struggling for survival. Your sense?
I think the key issue here is the cadres can't survive. If they operate, they become known. The Saudi counterterrorism forces are improving far more quickly than the terrorists are. All of the reports of divisions in the royal family have proved wrong. You've seen the Ministry of Interior, the Ministry of Defense, the Crown Prince's office, and the National Guard cooperate. And more than that, while we tend to focus on political reform, and that's moving slowly, the kingdom has used its oil wealth well. The money's gone into debt reduction, into education, health, infrastructure, and job creation. So you're not simply attacking the terrorists, you're attacking the causes of terrorism as well.
Hmm. Your sense that are these al-Qaeda operatives, and is al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia growing, getting new recruits, or diminishing?
Well, I think, again, you're talking about a very large country, and you're talking about almost certainly the ability to maintain recruits at the sort of tens and hundreds levels in a population of millions. What you don't see is any broad popular support. You don't see cadres building up quickly. They seem to at best be attracting people inside the kingdoms in the tens, not the hundreds.
Apparently there's been a government publicity campaign meant to alienate militants from the broad society. In your view, has that been working? Has that been part of what I'm hearing from you is a positive story here?
I think it has been effective. They've done a good job of portraying the terrorists as extremists. They've done a good job of working with the clergy, which is paid by the government. There are no madrasas in Saudi Arabia. There are no independent mosques. And getting them to describe these groups as deviants, as people outside the mainstream of Islam, which is perfectly true. Frankly, al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia or in Arabia is so extreme that it doesn't seem to have the judgment or ability to adapt politically to broaden its appeal.
Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. As always, thank you, Anthony.
Thank you.
Pope John Paul II's last testament was released today. In it, the ailing pope wrote that he considered resigning in 2000. Also, he thought about being buried in his native Poland, but he left it up to the College of Cardinals to decide, an unusual move for a pope who made so many decisions so decisively. Much has been said in the days since the death of John Paul about his unwavering moral compass, his disdain of, say, public polls. But some theologians say polling is a way of taking the pulse of the Church, which has changed its stance in the past. And this week, an Associated Press poll shows how far many Americans are from some key doctrines of the late pope. 64% felt women should be allowed to become priests. Here with more on the pope's legacy regarding women and women's issues, Marianne Hinsdale, Associate Professor of Theology at Boston College. She's also a Catholic nun. And Sister Marianne, Dr. Hinsdale, let me start by quoting the National Catholic Reporter's Vatican correspondent, John Allen. He writes that if John Paul had been a politician, educated Western women would be considered his most difficult constituency. Your thoughts?
I think John Allen has a pretty good take on that.
Yeah.
Educated Western women who expect to be consulted and to have participation in all the areas that affect their lives feel that that's been closed out for them in the Church.
And we should rush to point out that there are many educated Western women who would completely disagree with what you just said.
That's true.
And embrace everything the Pope has said. But let's talk about some of the things that he has done for women. And others have pointed out that a lot of American women in particular may not even know that. What are some of the things that this Pope has done for women that are seen as groundbreaking?
Well, he has appointed some women recently to certain posts within the Vatican. I'm thinking, for instance, of Marianne Glendon, a Harvard Law professor who has been named, I think it's the president of Pontifical Academy of Sciences, which is certainly something. However, I must qualify that at this point in time, congregations still must be headed by ordained priests and, in fact, bishops and often archbishops. And with women being excluded from those offices, they will never be able to assume the roles of leadership. You also have, although this isn't directly due to Pope John Paul II, you have more and more women functioning in the day-to-day operation of dioceses in the world.
How much of this is because of, as you've said, goodwill towards women, and how much is because of a shortage of priests?
That, yes, definitely. But also there was a dramatically new recognition of the role of the laity in the Catholic Church.
So, and on that note, the Pope is very clear that women will not and should not be ordained as priests. Why?
Well, there are a number of reasons, and he's not the first pope to take that position. Paul VI in 1977 also issued an apostolic letter that tried to explain the reasons for why women, why the official teachers of the Catholic Church didn't feel itself authorized to ordain women. There had been a number of study commissions, biblical scholars and other theologians who've studied this and have come up with suggestions that, in fact, the tradition would be open to such a development. However, the door was definitively, that's the word that Pope John Paul II used, closed in 1994, I believe it was, with his apostolic letter Ordinatio Sacerdotalis, which said that the Church didn't feel itself authorized to break from what it saw as the continuous tradition of the Catholic Church and only ordaining men. Now, that is a complicated question, but a lot of people asked, is that the end? Because people still were talking about it. The polls that you've cited also say that there are a lot of people in different parts of the world, most notably in North America and Europe, but also in the so-called developing third world countries who have experienced the ministries of women and are asking, well, why not? Why not actually officially ordain them? And Cardinal Ratzinger, in a follow-up document, in a sense tried to answer this question and said what the Pope had said in the document, Ordinatio Sacerdotalis, in fact was definitive. And so a question has arisen about whether that was saying that this teaching now that women cannot be ordained is infallible teaching.
Can you just very briefly define definitive
and infallible.
Thank you.
Actually, the difference between definitive and infallible is precisely the crux of the issue. In the minds of Cardinal Ratzinger and in the mind of the Pope, definitive meant infallible. In the minds of many Catholic theologians who have studied these formulations of Catholic Church teaching, it doesn't mean that. And so how do you say that the tradition doesn't allow this, but in fact we have this tradition has allowed it, and this of course is
but
what
in other churches.
Well, but the Holy Spirit doesn't really discriminate according mm-hmm. to our denominational differences, and I think this is a fundamental common belief of all the Christian churches, that the Holy Spirit is always operative in the church. And I guess to close the door, and by saying that this is infallible and may not even be discussed, is something that theologians have asked whether this really fits what constitutes an infallible statement. But all I'm saying right now is that there is a concept within Catholic theology and with a longstanding tradition of the Church called the sense of the faithful. The problem is we don't know how to determine what the sense of the faithful is. The Catholic Church doesn't operate by polls, but we don't have any sort of organized mechanism for trying to just determine what the sense of the faithful is, except the passage of time. Mm. And so this is why this becomes sort of a question. I think it points to the aspect of this 25, 6, 7-year-long papacy that some people feel that the Pope spoke perhaps too firmly and too assuredly about knowing what the plan of Christ is and was. And perhaps we need to give a little more room to the action of the Holy Spirit. It's been shown over the course of Christian history that sometimes authors, even popes, in fact, have said things that, in fact, the Holy Spirit has developed in a much different sort of direction.
Can you understand the Catholics who just are made very upset by this notion of changing, of making women priests? It's a very upsetting notion. Can you?
I can. And ironically, I sometimes encounter that sort of obstinacy towards change among younger people than older people. It may be that they are wedded to a notion of tradition that is very static, or it may also be that they haven't really had an experience of women mediating the sacred to them. Mm-hmm. And I think in more and more parishes today, you have that experience. Now, that doesn't mean to say that because of that, the Catholic Church will, with the new pope, ordain women. I really don't think that's going to happen. On the other hand, who knows what the Holy Spirit will bring about? That's what I love about the Catholic Church, is that we're open to the Spirit.
Marianne Hinsdale is a Catholic nun and associate professor of theology at Boston College. When we come back, her thoughts on the Church's ban on contraception and whether the Pope is infallible on that. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing with Mary Ann Hinsdale, Catholic nun and associate professor of theology at Boston College, on the legacy of Pope John Paul II, looking now at his absolute insistence during his papacy on a total ban on artificial birth control, not even allowing condom use to prevent the spread of AIDS. Now, the Church says all forms of birth control, except the rhythm method, are a mortal sin for married Catholics. So, Sister Mary Ann, Dr. Hinsdale, what's the fallout from this teaching? Population expert Dr. Stephen Mumford says the Church's teaching on contraception has led to an implosion in papal authority and a collapse of the institution from within.
The fact of the matter is, I think you just need to look at the size of Catholic families, particularly in the developed countries, to know that Catholics aren't following the teaching of Humanae Vitae, which was the encyclical that defined or continued, actually, the ban on the use of artificial contraception.
Let's talk about that for just a second, because that was in 1968, Pope Paul VI encyclical. But it came after a papal task force of lay people and church leaders, and they had recommended, by a vote that was leaked to the public, I mean, so everyone knew, they had recommended changing the church's position on contraception. Why even bother having the task force if he wasn't going to...
Why the Pope did that is a good question. Perhaps he was concerned about other parts of the world. Perhaps he was fearful that it would lessen the authority of the church if it was perceived that the church was changing its position. But in fact, the church has changed its position on many practical moral matters like this.
Well, let's explain, because this wouldn't just be saying, oh, okay, you could all go ahead and use birth control. It would change the absolute notion, as I understand it, of what the act of love was supposed to be for, which was for procreation, and it would change that.
Well, no, actually, the Second Vatican Council was very clear that the primary action or of intercourse was also to enhance the love relationship of the couple. And so it wouldn't be just to say that the only reason to have sexual relations for a married couple would be simply to have children, but the teaching is that they would be open to life. Now, when one is open to life, this is where we have some problems with the issues of artificial contraception. You mentioned the issue of with regard to the use of condoms to prevent AIDS or sexually transmitted diseases, for example. And here you do have some pluralism within the Catholic Church right now. You have bishops, for example, in parts of Africa where HIV/AIDS is just simply rampant. It's an incredible pandemic. Advocating that, and to my knowledge, in some instances, the Vatican, the Pope, did not, in a sense, interfere with that. So I think that there's a possibility there that this is not of the same matter in terms of Catholic Church teaching with regard to, we're not talking about the divinity of Christ or the Holy Trinity or the belief in the resurrection. And so I think this is still a problematic issue. And to go back to what I said was important in trying to determine Catholic Church teaching, you have to ask, is this the sense of the faithful? Is the Spirit working in the faithful community of Catholics? And has this teaching been received by Catholics? That's another important doctrinal criteria for evaluating whether something is in fact a church teaching and certainly an infallible church teaching. It's called the doctrine of reception. And it is clear, I think, that the teaching with regard to the use of artificial contraception within marriage. I always have to add that for my undergraduates, because we're not the church, of course, does not condone premarital sex. And so we're talking about faithful married couples who find that the need to space their children or to plan their family has to be done with a more reliable means of birth control. And you just need to look at the sizes of Catholic families today to know that this teaching seems not to have been received.
Very complicated.
It is.
It is very complicated, but I guess, you know, people just want to know, is there a sense that it might change? Is there a sense that the church stand on either ordaining women or allowing forms of contraception other than the rhythm method, that might happen in their lifetimes? What's your sense of that?
Well, I have no crystal ball, and I think, again, this depends upon whether you agree that either of those issues have been, in a sense, defined in an infallible way. And certainly, I think, with the issue of contraception, because the criteria that would need to be employed about whether this teaching has truly been received by the faithful seems not to have been, that I don't think you can say that that's been an infallibly defined doctrine. And then we have a statement saying that the issue around women's ordination has been definitively settled. And the question is, well, does that mean it's infallible?
Right.
And so these are sort of theological fine points. Right now, the positions are clear. And even with regard to the issue of women's ordination, the position of the Vatican would be that there's no more discussion to be had on this topic. However, that hasn't prevented people from raising questions. So if the Holy Spirit is still active in the church, I can't be the one who say it's never going to come up again, despite what the Pope and the Office of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith have said about it. However, I think who is the next pope will give us probably, and how old that new pope will be, will give us a pretty good idea of whether or not anyone in their present lifetime can expect to see any change.
Sister Marianne, I just wanted to ask you, you work with students. You said some of them, for instance, aren't as eager as your mom, for instance, to see women ordained as priests. But how are they feeling in general about the death of their pope?
I think that young people today, although I did say that some are resistant to change, in fact, on a lot of issues, would like to see change. And while they regret the passing of this pope because it's simply the only one they've ever known.
And he's very lovable.
Yes, very, very much. I think that, he was almost like had a rock star quality in his meetings with young people. I think it could be argued how much he actually did listen to young people and what kind of conversations he actually had with them. They don't always seem to be the conversations that I have with the students in my class.
Marianne Hinsdale is a Catholic nun and associate professor of theology at Boston College. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The state senate of Connecticut easily okayed a bill yesterday that would recognize civil unions between same-sex couples. The House takes it up next week. The measure would give gay and lesbian couples many of the same benefits that married couples have. This comes as voters in Kansas passed a constitutional amendment Tuesday banning gay marriage. Kaven Peterson has been following the issue of gay marriage for Stateline.org. That's the online journal that looks at issues before state legislatures, and he joins us now. Kaven, let's start with Connecticut, which moved closer to becoming the second state to legalize civil unions, a la Vermont. But Connecticut's approach was different. Why?
Connecticut will be the first state to voluntarily adopt a civil union statute in Vermont. The courts had mandated that the state do something to allow same-sex couples the same rights and privileges that heterosexual couples enjoy.
And courts were also involved in the Massachusetts decision to legalize gay marriage.
That's correct. In fact, it was the same lawyers that argued in Vermont, argued in Massachusetts to legalize same-sex marriage. And in fact, even though the state legislature in Connecticut may adopt civil unions by next week, there's also litigation pending in Connecticut that could see same-sex marriage legalized, in the next year or two. And it's, again, the same folks that were arguing in Massachusetts and Vermont, they now have a case pending in Connecticut.
But again, the current decision on whether to legalize civil unions in Connecticut bubbled up through the legislature. Where does it stand?
Yesterday, the Senate approved that measure, and it's believed that there are enough votes in the state house to pass it next week. And the governor has not explicitly said she would sign it, but she has indicated that she supports the idea of civil unions.
Well, now you mentioned gay marriage. Supporters of gay marriage, even opponents of gay marriage, both agree that if civil union legislation is passed in Connecticut, then the next step is same-sex marriage. And opponents say they're going to push for a statewide referendum, a vote on the issue. Any sense of how the issue would work if it goes to the people in Connecticut?
At no time has any same-sex marriage ban failed to pass in a statewide referendum. We have 18 states that have adopted constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage. And in every case, it was a fairly overwhelming majority that adopted these measures.
In fact, let's move to Kansas, because voters in Kansas voted in a special referendum to amend the Constitution there. What happened there?
That's correct. There was a sense of urgency in Kansas. I guess the legislature acted very quickly to put this on the ballot this week. They voted overwhelmingly on Tuesday to become the 18th state to adopt a same-sex marriage ban in their constitution.
And voters turned out in droves, we understand.
There was a much higher turnout than would have been expected. This is normally just a time to elect city officials, city council officials. So there was a higher turnout. There was some interest in this.
And what's happening elsewhere in other states? Are any other states considering amending their constitutions?
Yes. We're not seeing the same urgency that we did last year. There aren't any more votes scheduled for 2005, but Alabama, South Dakota, and Tennessee, they have all scheduled votes in 2006. There's a good chance that Wisconsin will join them soon. There are amendments pending in about 14 state legislatures, but the sense we have at Stateline is that a lot of these are probably going to sit this year, and then we'll see them come up in the next legislative session in 2006, and we'll probably see quite a few states voting again during the November elections in 2006.
We've been talking about civil unions, and as we said, Vermont, the only state to have civil unions. Connecticut looks as if it will pass civil union legislation. But what about domestic partnerships? This week, an appeals court in California rejected a challenge to a state law that gives same-sex domestic partners many of the same rights as marriage couples. What's the difference between domestic partnerships and civil unions?
A lot of it is really semantics. Each state law is slightly different. In California, the domestic partnership law is actually very similar to Vermont's civil union law. It provides nearly every state-level benefit that you would get if you were married. It doesn't provide any of the federal benefits, but in California, it's very similar to the civil union statute in Vermont.
So how many other states outside of California have that civil union-like domestic partnership legislation?
Well, three other states provide actually a slightly more limited benefits. New Jersey has a domestic partnership registry. Maine provides a few benefits, and Hawaii has a reciprocal beneficiary. It basically allows same-sex couples to sign up, make them eligible for health care, and making some of the decisions, end-of-life decisions that might come up.
Congress has been quiet on this issue. What's in the future? What do you see ahead as tripping this debate again?
Mm-hmm. There is legislation that has been introduced in Congress that would propose an amendment to the U.S. Constitution to ban same-sex marriage nationwide. Now, the president has endorsed this idea. Right now, there are not the votes to pass it. It failed in a vote last July. But if this issue comes up again, if we see a state like Washington where there's a lawsuit pending, it's already been argued before the Washington State Supreme Court. If we see a state like Washington or California actually follow Massachusetts' footsteps and legalize same-sex marriage, you might see the debate resurrected in Congress, and we might see an amendment to the U.S. Constitution put to the states for ratification.
Kaven Peterson of Stateline.org. We've been talking about the issue of gay marriage, civil unions, and domestic partnerships across the U.S. Kaven, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Robin.
And this note about a story we've been following. Senator Mel Martinez, a Republican from Florida, says an unsigned memo that made its way around Capitol Hill in the final days of Terri Schiavo's life originated in his office. The memo surfaced as Congress was considering intervening in the case, which it eventually did. The memo, to Republicans, said that the fight underway around Schiavo's feeding tube was, quote, a great political issue and a tough issue for Democrats. It continued, this is an important moral issue, and the pro-life base will be excited that the Senate is debating it. When the memo appeared, Democrats said it proved Republicans were trying to make political gains from the Schiavo case. Republicans challenged the authenticity of the document. And up until yesterday, Martinez disavowed any knowledge of the memo, but then, in a written statement, acknowledged that one of his senior aides had written it, and that aide has resigned. Well, coming up on Here and Now.
Des yeux qui font baisser les miens. Un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche, voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens.
The music of French chanteuse Edith Piaf has generated a huge cult following. Now, a Boston alternative rock band is generating buzz by singing just the songs of Piaf. We'll hear from the band Ziaf. That's coming up. You're listening to Here and Now.
Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours. Oh, que ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur, une part de bonheur, non, je connais la cause. Et lui, pour moi, aperçoit alors je sens en moi mon cœur qui bat des nuits d'amour à plus finir un grand bonheur.
Fever Pitch is the new comedy starring Jimmy Fallon as a die-hard Red Sox fan and Drew Barrymore as his long-suffering girlfriend. The film ends with their characters running onto the field as the real Red Sox won the World Series last year. But as the film opens tomorrow, the Sox are trailing the New York Yankees 2-1 going into Monday's Fenway Park home opener, where the Sox will receive their World Series ring as the Yankees look on. NPR's Only a Game host Bill Littlefield talked with New York Post sports columnist Mike Vaccaro and asked what, if any, conclusions could be drawn from this week's 3-game Sox-Yankees series.
I guess the biggest conclusion is that people will always go crazy when these two teams play, no matter what time of the year it is, whether it's October or whether it's April. October, obviously, is when it really matters the most, as the Red Sox proved last year and the Yankees proved the year before that. But I think everybody just gets real intrigued by what happens when these two teams share a field together, and the fact that it happened the first 3 games of the season. You know, I guess it's logic tells us it's too early to really draw any conclusions, but viscerally, it tells us that we really care about it when they get together.
Well, around these parts, the Sox-Yankees rivalry is touted as being the greatest rivalry in all of sports. But I wonder if New Yorkers see it that way.
I don't see it that way now as more than ever. I think last year they did, but they really only gave it lip service because it was something that interested them more than something that consumed them, just because the Yankees always seemed to find a way whenever they had to beat the Red Sox. I think the fact that the Red Sox won last year in the minds of many Yankees fans legitimized the idea of this actually being a rivalry. I think people like to kind of put aside the idea of what rivalry really meant, because this was hardly like Army-Navy, where one team wins half the time and the other team wins the other half. But I think now the fact that the Red Sox actually are in play and actually have, you know, counterpunched, if you will, I think the rivalry itself on the field means more to New Yorkers now than it ever did before, because I think for New York, you're talking about the fans, at least. I mean, they really want a great shot at redemption. I think the players do too, but the fans are the ones who kind of vocalize their opinions a little bit louder and a little bit better.
How does one convince fans of the Cardinals, the Cubs, the Giants, or the Dodgers of the preeminence of this particular rivalry?
Two things. One, the fact that it really does go back to the very beginning, 1903, when they first started playing each other. In fact, the second game the two teams played against each other, there was very nearly a brawl at first base. But beyond that, I mean, the proximity is such. I mean, I realize that when the Giants and the Dodgers played in New York, I mean, the proximity was an issue there also, and maybe that's what really kind of rivaled this as a rivalry. But I mean, you know, with New York and Boston, you have a couple of cities within 250 miles of each other. You have a lot of transplant New Yorkers who live in Boston or go to school in Boston. Similarly, you have a lot of native Bostonians who live in New York. The fans are continually in each other's faces and in each other's spaces, and I think that really is what perpetuates it as much as anything else, because it becomes a very, you know, passionate thing the moment that you walk into one of the other ballparks, especially if you happen to be wearing the colors of the other team.
All right, Mike, in the early going, the Yankees won 2 of the first 3 games between the two teams, but their star reliever, Mariano Rivera, couldn't get anybody out on the Red Sox throughout the Red Sox lineup. Are you ready to make some predictions as far as how things will go between these two teams from here on out?
Looking at the rosters right now, Bill, I would say that I think the Yankees have the edge, just because I think they have a little bit more starting pitching, and I think they're just a little deeper. That obviously can change come July 31st, the trading deadline, as the Red Sox proved so eloquently last year. But I do think you're right. I think you make a point that Mario Rivera is the real wild card here, because he's been such a reliable piece of the Yankee puzzle for so long. He really isn't the downside of his career, and the Yankees can't rely on him to go 1-2-3 and ninth innings all across the summer. I think that the Red Sox definitely then gain an upper hand.
All right, final question. Will movie fans in New York be lining up in great numbers tomorrow to see Fever Pitch?
I think if it had the original ending, I think they would have been lining around the block. I'm not so sure that New York fans are quite so amused by the new ending, which reflects obviously the actual ending. So I would hope so, because I think that I think Yankees fans can certainly understand and appreciate the fervency that with which Red Sox fans have followed their team through the years, because they do the same exact thing with the Yankees. They just haven't had as many potholes to try and negotiate through the years. I would think that if the reviews of the movie that I've heard from some people who have seen it are as positive as the movie as it really is, I think they'll enjoy it. I would hope they would go see it. But New Yorkers have a long memory, and it's not above them to be spiteful.
Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's sports program Only a Game, spoke to Mike Vaccaro, sports columnist for the New York Post and author of the book about the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry called Emperors and Idiots. Red Sox fans, of course, proudly being the latter. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose.
The haunting voice of French chanteuse Edith Piaf. The legendary singer died in 1963 after a tumultuous life begun on the streets of Paris. Her mother was an alcoholic street singer who may have been a prostitute. Her father, a street acrobat. But the beauty of her music lives on. Edith Piaf's music was the muse that prompted four young musicians from Boston to form the group Ziaf. Their latest record of Edith Piaf interpretations is called Hello Boy, You Come With Me. And the members of the group join us now in the studio. We've got Carol Nam Kung, Catherine Capozzi, Tamara Gooding, who are all musicians, and singing the words of Edith Piaf, Christine Zuffery. And welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Now, you sing Piaf, but your band is called Ziaf, borrowing the Z from singer Christine Zuffery's last name. But I want to start with you, Catherine Capozzi. You're the guitarist. Why an Edith Piaf cover band?
Well, the band actually happened as an accident, and we don't like to say we're a cover band. We interpret the work of Edith Piaf. Mm-hmm. But actually, the three of us, Christine, Tamara, and I, were in a band called All the Queen's Men, and we had did a residency at a club here in Boston, and someone... We performed La Vie en Rose for one of the nights, and from there someone basically challenged us to a set of Edith Piaf. So we said, okay, we'll do it for a Bastille Day show. We did it, and it was a success, and people said, you should do it again and again. And so eventually we just kept doing it again and again, and this group formed based on that one song that we did that one night.
But Tamara, All the Queen's Men was a rock band.
Yes, rocktronica. Well, cross between rock and electronic.
That's quite a transition.
It is.
Especially, you're the drummer, right?
Yes.
So especially for you, I would think.
With All the Queen's Men, I was playing electronic drums, so this was nice for me to go back and revisit, you know, where I started, which is the acoustic drums. But, yes, the music definitely is a lot different. We're not, with All the Queen's Men, we were kind of locked into loops and samples and things, so it was very much always right on the money. Very consistent, where with this music there's a lot more breath, there's a lot more room for pushing and pulling.
And so. These are songs.
These are songs.
Yeah, and Christine Zuffery, who again, you do the singing.
Yes.
The language might have come to you more naturally. Do I understand you're from Switzerland?
Yes, from the southern French part of Switzerland.
And so you speak French?
I do.
But had you sung Piaf?
Never before.
You said, Catherine, that this is not cover, this is interpretation. So what does that mean to you, Christine?
Well, it means we're not trying to copy her. I'm not trying to look like her or sound like her. We just kind of take the songs and just play the songs with our own personalities and our own voices in it.
I would like to hear a little more of Ziaf, but first I'm going to go over to Carol, who plays piano in the
yes.
group.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, I'm thinking that for you, there's room for a lot of interpretation playing the piano.
Yes, all the orchestration has to be pared down to three instruments, so it can be a bit of a challenge, but it's fun. It's the opposite of music.
Yes, well, you're the violins, you're the horn section, potentially, you're trying to put it all...
Accordion, yes, yeah. Kathy and I try to split up all the parts.
Piaf with Edith Piaf's Je ne regrette rien. Have I got that right?
Yes.
You say it because it's better when you say it.
It's a non, je ne regrette rien.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, Christine Zufri, who is charged with, you know, singing this song. When you're singing it, are you conscious of what an impact Edith Piaf had?
Well, since I really didn't pay attention to her, it's not as big of a deal than if it was all over my life. Edith Piaf just came into my life probably about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and so I'm not really carrying the myth from my old days.
But I wonder, Catherine, as you put this sound together, obviously you've, you know, it started as a challenge. Mm-hmm. You know, bet you can't do this.
Yeah.
And as it's progressed and it's become a group, what have you found out about her? What do you think about her?
Well, I mean, for me, the thing that I always think about Edith Piaf, the more I learn about Edith Piaf is just how much of a rock and roller she actually was in terms of her life. And that's in my taking away because that's my background. It isn't jazz. And so I think when I read about her life, the more I realize that she led a life that was probably equivalent to Hendrix or Jimmy Morrison or Janis Joplin, but just earlier. And you can hear that in her voice.
Mm. Let's listen to another cut.
Non, la vie n'est pas triste.
Vine Patrice from Ziaf's new CD, Hello Boy, You Come With Me. Christine Zufri, you sing those lyrics. What do they mean?
They mean that no life isn't sad. And that's actually a very, very unknown song of Edith Piaf.
I find this so interesting, Carol, the pianist in the group, that, you know, here you are suddenly Edith Piaf experts. I mean, have you completely immersed in Piaf?
I don't know if we're experts, but we do enjoy her music quite a bit, and it's really great to be able to revive her music, not just for the older generation who did know her, but for the younger generation who did not know her or only heard of the legend of her.
Pick for me one of Edith Piaf's better-known songs that we can listen to.
Let's see, a fun, good one would be La Foule.
Catherine, how long do you think you're all going to do this?
Oh, there's no end. I mean, we're kind of on this ride with this band that we didn't expect, and last year was an amazing year for us. We played over 60 shows. We toured in Europe twice, and there isn't really an end to when we're going to stop it. Yeah. It's just a continuing. We're just part of this experience that's taking us places.
Edith Piaf is apparently taking you places.
Yeah, who knew?
Channeling her.
Yeah.
Catherine Capozzi, Tamara Gooding, Carol Nemkung, and Christine Zufri, members of the band Ziaf. Their new CD is called Hello Boy, You Come With Me. And Christine, where did that title come from?
It's actually a lyric of the song C'est un beau, where she says it in English and she says it in Amigo te quiero mucho and Liebling komm dort mit mir in German. Looking for a title, it's always hard. We thought it was a really fun phrase that everyone could understand.
That's Christine Zufri. She sings the words of Edith Piaf in the band Ziaf. Thanks all of you for coming in to tell us about it.
Thank you
very much.
Hello boy, you come with me. Amigo, te quiero mucho. Liebling, come dormir mir.
For more information about Ziaf and a list of their upcoming shows, including one this Saturday at the Lizard Lounge in Cambridge, Massachusetts, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
C'est un bourg à Santiago, à Whitechapel, Borneo. C'est un bourg à Santiago, à Rotterdam, à Frisco.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.